imagining myself flying among the stars, as Gran-Gran had taught me. I felt myself drifting. Maybe I could follow those invisible trails. Did some of them lead to Detritus and the superiority forces posted there? But there was nothing that gave me a clue toward that end. I did feel something else nearby, though, a kind of humming familiarity. What was that? Braid, I realized, recognizing the feeling from earlier. She's not in the room, but she's near. I opened my eyes and glanced around. The bustling room was filled with aliens eating and drinking, or in the case of some very strange rocky creatures, pouring liquid on their heads. The sensation was coming from outside the room. I made an excuse to the others, saying I needed to find a restroom. Morimer pointed the way, and I ducked out of the dining hall, glancing in the direction Morimer had indicated. A string of doors ran down the hallway there, each with a sign identifying the kind of disposal unit contained therein. I glanced in the other direction, where Braid's cytonic sensation seemed to be coming from. There were no guards that I could see, so I slipped away down the hall. The feeling got stronger as I reached a door off to the side. It was cracked, and I peered in to see that indeed, Braid was there. And she was speaking with a group of Dione officials, as well as Winsick. Chapter 17. I crouched beside the door, trying to listen to what Winsick and the other officials were saying inside.
"Hey," Embot said in my ear, nearly making me jump. "Spensa, what are you doing?"
I gritted my teeth, concentrating on the sounds from behind the door.
"Oh," Embot said after a moment. "Are you hiding? What's wrong? I was computing our flight back to Starsight. Weren't you going to go release secretions in the lavatory? Spensa, did you release them in an inappropriate place? Is that why you're hiding?"
"Shut up," I whispered as softly as I could. "I'm trying to spy."
"Oh," Embot said.
The others were speaking too quietly for my translator to pick them up. I could hear muffled voices, but couldn't make anything out.
"Do you maybe want me to enhance your bracelet's auditory reception capacities? Then wire the translations directly into your ear, so your pin won't give you away?" Embot asked. "This will help you spy more efficiently."
"Yes," I whispered back.
"Fine. No need to be terse."
He wirelessly shut off my pin, then began piping the voices from the other room directly into my earpiece. My bracelet sound pickup was much more sensitive than the pins or my normal hearing, and Embot was way better at isolating voices from background chatter.
"Should have seen that this would be such a disaster," one of the officials was saying. "These drone pilots were trained to fight against the humans at the Detritus Preserve. They came out shooting far too aggressively." "These casualties are unfortunate."
That was Winsick's voice, which had a calm tone to it.
"But you needn't worry about repercussions. This was an accident, not an act of aggression."
"There are a dozen dead," another official said.
These Dions sounded far less calm in private than they had outside when talking to that gorilla Burl.
"The poor families." "Those poor families will be destroyed entirely if we don't prepare a fighting force to resist the Delvers," Winsick said. "My, my. My department's suppressors will deal with any outcries of injustice. You have done your duty well."
"Yes, well," another official said. "I guess. As long as you think the test worked. But was it necessary for you to bring your human here, Winsick? She makes me uncomfortable."
"My, my, Tismar," Winsick said. "You worry far too much. And about the wrong things. Consider instead the Department of Species Integration and their insistence on entering several very aggressive species into our contest. Kuna is up to something here. That newcomer, Alanique, uses human combat strategies. Her people are dangerous from their long association with the Scourge and should remain isolated."
I frowned as I leaned against the wall, then felt something. A mind pressing against my own.
What? Said an official inside. What is wrong? Why is your human standing up, so alert like that? She's properly trained, isn't she?
Idiot. If I could hear Braid with my senses, then of course she'd hear me back. I spun and scrambled back down the hallway. Sweating, I slowed down to walk back into the dining room. I tried to be nonchalant as I sat down at our table. A moment later, Winzik appeared in the doorway, looking around the room. As I slipped back into conversation with Hesho and Morimer, from the corner of my eye, I could see that the Krell's faceplate pointed in our direction, lingering on us. Then he retreated. A short time later, a group of Dione officials entered the room bearing tablets. They moved through the tables, talking to the pilots, giving instructions.
And here we have Alanik, said a Dione official with crimson skin as they arrived at our table. The non-citizen. You performed quite well in the test. Excellent flying and rescuing others in need. Delightful. We have organized you in a flight with the Big Enough and its crew. I assume you'll find this acceptable.
I glanced at Hesho, who stood up and clapped once. It seemed like a sign of assent.
I'd like that, I said. Thank you.
Now, the official said, scrolling their tablet screen and reading. There is a matter of some sensitivity I would discuss with you two. We have added another member to your flight. A skilled and capable pilot. Very skilled.
Then we shall welcome them, Hesho said. Who is this person?
It's a human, the official said.
Morimer gasped softly, putting their hands to their face. Hesho immediately sat back down in his seat, and a Kitson appeared with a fan and began fanning him rapidly. I tried my best to look surprised and horrified.
Now, you needn't be worried, the official continued, speaking quickly. This human is fully licensed. I will provide you with documentation.
Why, Hesho said, would we be training to fight one evil by using another?
Yes, I said. Those things enslaved my people for decades. I wouldn't think you'd set them loose on the galaxy. This human is very well trained, the official said. We need to test whether she can fight Delvers.
What if this human is perfect at fighting them? Hesho asked. Will you create flights and fleets only of humans? This is hiring the wolf to guard your sheep. In the end, you will still lose your sheep.
I found that metaphor curious. Had he actually used the words wolf and sheep? Or had he spoken alien words that got translated into something similar in English? Either way, I wasn't sure what I thought of Braid joining our flight. She was a Cytonic. Would she be able to, with time, tell that I was secretly human? I had the suspicion that she was being assigned to my flight specifically to keep an eye on me. At the same time, she probably understood much more about being Cytonic. She might know the secret to making my powers work properly. She might be able to explain to me what I was, what we were.
I'm sure, I said slowly, that the superiority knows what it's doing.
My people have a long history with the humans, Hesho said, settling back beneath the fanning of his servant. Back in the days when we still had shadow walkers, our people walked between our world and Earth, the human homeworld. This is a bonfire awaiting a spark.
If this is not an acceptable situation, Your Majesty, the Dione said, we can remove you from the flight rolls.
I would, of course, have to ask my people, Hesho said, as I am not their king, but simply one equal among many in a perfectly legal democracy.
The other Kitson around him nodded vigorously in agreement, even while one fanned him and another served his food. So this means we passed the tests for sure, I said, diverting the topic. We're going to be trained to fight the Delvers?
Yes, the official said. We'll send a shuttle to pick you up tomorrow at 1000, starsight time. It will deliver you to our training grounds. I'm afraid you'll need to leave your own starships behind and train on our equipment, though we'll have an appropriate vessel prepared for the Kitson, Captain Hesho.
Superiority ships. Exactly what I was hoping for. I still didn't know how I was going to find a chance to steal a hyperdrive from my new ship, let alone get it to Embot and jump us back to Detritus. But at least I'd taken one major step toward accomplishing that goal. Though I'd want to triple check to make certain my hologram disguise would stay in place if I strayed too far from Embot.
To be extra careful regarding the human, the official said, we've placed a figment in your flight. You might have noticed that one was attending this test. This individual prefers to be addressed as a female and has asked that you call her simply Vapor.
Hesho sat up at this.
A figment, you say?
He said, tapping his furry chin with a single clawed finger.
This is some comfort, at least.
Huh? What was this? A figment? I looked around, trying to see if I could pick out what they were referencing. However, before I could ask, the official continued speaking.
Excellent, the official said, then pointed absently at Morimer. Now you, please follow me, and I'll tell you about your placement.
What? I said, suddenly alert.
Morimer isn't with us? They shall be placed in their own solo flight, the official said, as is appropriate.
Morimer stood up slowly, looking sad.
I enjoyed speaking with you, Alanik.
No, I said, feeling my face flush with outrage as I stood up.
We're a flight. Morimer stays with us.
Both Morimer and the official looked at me with shocked expressions. Well, let them be shocked. I folded my arms. What good is a flight of one?
Leave Morimer with us.
You already have four in your team, the official said. This is the number we decided as a flight size.
Surely there isn't an exact multiple of four in this room, I said, gesturing to the pilots filling the tables around us. Besides, we're already a strange flight with a human in it. So we could use the extra pilot with us, in case the vicious creature turns against us.
Well,
the official said, rattled as they typed on their tablet.
Well, I guess we can rearrange.
They glanced up at me warily, then went back to typing.
Just be ready for the shuttle pickup tomorrow. A superiority flight suit will be issued to you and will arrive in the morning. You'll be delivered back to Starsight each evening, so we'll not need to pack changes of clothing. But if you require sustenance at midday, be prepared with your own food supply. Be on time in the morning.
At that, the Dione turned and hurried away.
You didn't need to do that, Morimer said to me. I came into this knowing that I'd be isolated.
Yeah, well, I rarely let go of someone once I have my teeth in them, I said. It's the warrior's way.
What a profoundly disturbing metaphor, Morimer said, settling back down. Thank you, in any case. I should like to not be on my own.
Wait, I said, looking around our table. They said four people were in our team. Who is this Vapor they mentioned?
It's me.
A quiet whisper of a voice said. I jumped and turned to look, but no one was there. I was hit with the striking scent of cinnamon, burned cinnamon, actually.
Welcome, unseen one,
Hesho said, standing, then bowing low. The others of his crew did likewise.
You're invisible? I asked, surprised. I am a figment, said the soft, feminine voice.
And I realized I knew that voice. I'd heard it before.
The drone ship that helped me save Morimer, I said. You were on that ship.
Figments, Hesho said, are known to be able to infiltrate ships and take control of them.
So are all the drones piloted by people like you? I asked.
No, the disembodied voice said. There aren't many of us. I simply took control of one of the ships for this test, against the will of its remote pilot. Incredible. But what was she? A smell? Was I talking to a smell? The distinct scent trailed away, but I didn't know if that meant Vapor was leaving or something else. I found the idea of a creature that I couldn't see to be distinctly disturbing. Who knew when she would be watching us? The lunch was breaking up, creatures from other tables filing out to return to their ships. Hesho bade us farewell with gusto, then climbed down the ladders set up by his crew. Together, the group of over 50 diminutive foxes gathered their things and trotted out the doors. Mortimer and I followed, eventually emerging out into the open air at the top of the station. Black sky overhead, speckled with stars. Ships were launching a few at a time for the flight back to Starsight. I bade farewell to Mortimer, then walked over to Embot and hauled myself up onto his wing so I could get into the cockpit. "Some engineers came to try to inspect me while you were below," Embot said, "but I scared them away by making it seem like they'd accidentally tripped an alarm system."
"Good thinking," I said.
"It was kind of like a lie," he said. "I can do it, as you said, under the right circumstances."
As we prepared to take off, I felt something against my mind again. I glanced to where the sensation seemed to be coming from and noticed a set of partially opened hangar doors. I could see a shadow standing inside. Braid, watching my ship.
"I don't like the idea of you going off on your own tomorrow," Embot said, "flying another ship."
"Jealous?"
"Maybe. It would be cool if I could feel that. But more, I think it's dangerous. We'll need to double-check your bracelet's holographic projector. Its CPU should be able to manage your hologram without my aid, but we'll want to observe it first. It would be better if I could go with you."
"I don't really see that we have a choice," I said, as I lifted us up and away from the platform. "We need to get our hands on a superiority ship."
"It's possible they won't give you one that can hyperjump," Embot said. "At least not at first."
"I considered that," I said. "But if I can gain their trust, there's a good chance they'll relax their security around me. I might not be given a starfighter that can hyperjump, but I'll likely be near one. If I can't steal a hyperdrive, perhaps I can at least get some photos of one."
"Photos won't get us home."
"I know. I'm still working on that." As we flew toward Starsight and I thought it through, I realized that I had inadvertently been given a backup plan. Winzik and the others had just assigned me to the same flight as their pet human. Did Braid know there was an entire planet full of humans like her, only free? Might she be willing to escape there if I gave her the right opportunity? If I couldn't steal a hyperdrive from the superiority, maybe I could instead steal away one of their cytonics. Chapter 18. I settled Embot into place on the top of our embassy on Starsight, then sat back in my seat, suddenly exhausted. Being Alanik was taxing. I was accustomed to just going with my gut and doing what seemed natural for me. It had gotten me through life well so far. I'd admittedly earned the occasional bumper scrape, but I'd never had to worry about pretending to be someone other than myself. I sighed, finally hitting the canopy release and standing up to stretch. The embassy didn't have a ground crew to pull over steps for me, so I climbed out onto the wing, then hopped down.
"Overall," Embot said to me, "I think that went well. We're not dead, and you actually managed to get into their military."
"By the skin of my teeth," I said, grimacing as I remembered the Burl gorilla alien who had thrown the tantrum and been kicked out. That would have been me if I'd gotten to Winzik a tad earlier.
"Do your teeth have skin?" Embot asked.
"I don't think so," I said, walking over and hooking up Embot's charging cords and network link. Not sure where the saying comes from, actually.
"Hmm. Oh, well, it's from an English version of the Bible. That's a really antiquated version of the Book of Saints from Old Earth."
I got the last cord hooked up, then traipsed down the steps.
Doomslug trilled at me excitedly from the bedroom when I checked on her. I'd set up a litter box for her and some chopped mushrooms, which, judging by the crumbs left, she'd found acceptable as a meal. I gave her a scratch, then noted a little light on the wall. It was blinking, indicating that I had a delivery, so I tromped down to the bottom floor and checked the delivery box. Before flying out this morning, I'd made a few orders to test my requisition abilities. Inside the box, I found a bundle of new clothing in my size, along with some toiletries. I grabbed everything and headed up to the kitchen, where I fried a small algae patty and ate it in a bun. Then I walked back to my bathroom. It was still a little strange that I had one all to myself. Scud. I had this entire building all to myself. Well, myself and my pet slug, who insisted I give her another head scratch as I passed her in the hall. In the bathroom's mirror, I looked at myself, or the illusion of Alanique that I wore. Doomslug doesn't notice I'm not wearing my real face, I thought. She obviously worked by scent and sound, as she didn't have eyes. It hit me that my disguise was even more tenuous than I thought. What about that creature Vapor, who was a scent? Did I have to worry she'd know I was human? I groaned softly, feeling weighed down. I flipped off the lights, then, with a sigh of relief, took off my hologram bracelet. Though MBOT had scanned the place for spy devices, I wanted to be extra careful, so I kept the bracelet on at all times. For now, I wanted to be myself. Even in the dark, even alone, even for just a little while. I cleansed, and it felt luxurious to not be pressed for time. Back on Detritus, it seemed I had always been running to some training exercise or another. Here, though, I could simply rest and let the pod's cleansing agents wash me. I finally pulled myself out, then sighed and put the bracelet back on. I turned on the light and pulled a set of loose, generic clothing from my bundle. They looked kind of like the scrubs that medical personnel wore. I figured these would make good all-purpose work or sleeping clothing. I sorted through the toiletries. Hopefully, the people watching my requisition orders wouldn't wonder why I'd forgotten my toothpaste. Though I'd checked with MBOT before ordering everything, I still had an amusing time looking over the warning label on the back of the tube. My PIN translated the words, and it listed which species in the galaxy would find the toothpaste toxic. Running a galactic empire seemed to carry a lot of strange problems I'd never considered. Brushing my teeth in front of the mirror, I found the toothpaste actually had a nice minty taste to it, way better than the bitter stuff we used back home. Such were apparently the benefits of having an actual economy and infrastructure, instead of being forced to repurpose ancient biorefineries to manufacture toothpaste. My hair was longer than I used to keep it, and was fortunately about the length of Alanique's, inching past my shoulders. I'd kept it short when I'd been young, partially because I'd hated the color. Heroes from Grand-Grand's stories had all had raven black hair or golden flax hair, maybe the occasional fire scarlet color thrown in for variety. Nobody in those tales had dirty brown hair. It was white now, though, with the hologram on. I ran my fingers through it, and the illusion really was perfect, with each individual strand recolored. My expressions also mapped quite well to Alanique's face, and I couldn't feel anything different when I poked my skin, though I knew that my features and hers weren't the same. The only things that were off were the bone ridges Alanique had under her eyes and along the sides of her face. Those were pure illusion, and if I stuck my finger into them, the hologram distorted. Still, the bracelet was good enough to make my hair seem to brush against the ridges, instead of clipping through the center of them when the two touched. I stared at myself in the mirror, smiling, frowning, trying to find some error in the way it all looked. But it was an excellent illusion. I could almost believe I was wearing makeup. It was no surprise when I found myself thinking about Alanique. Had she worried about how to fit her hair into her helmet? What would she think of me imitating her? Don't trust their peace, their lies. I brushed my hair, then trailed out into the hall and down the stairs to my bedroom.
Ah, Embot said to me. You'll be interested to read this. We've just received a communication back from Alanik's people, sent, supposedly, via secure but unmonitored superiority channels.
I don't doubt for a moment that they read it anyway, I said, settling down at the bedroom's desk. Let's see what it says. Embot displayed the message at the desk's workstation, translated to English. It gave a bland response to our bland rundown of events, which was promising. It didn't seem they'd immediately contacted the superiority. And is there an encrypted hidden message, like the one we sent?
Yes, Embot said. It's a very interesting cipher, based on the number of letters in each word, mapped to a one-time pad message with the key in your PIN. Completely unbreakable without the PIN. I guess that's more than what you want to know. Anyway, the encrypted message simply says, "We want to speak to Alanik.
Send back a report on today's test, and in code, she will contact you when she is well. For now, I am embedded among the superiority, imitating her. Please do not give me away."
Sounds like a reasonable response, Embot said. I will construct that message.
I nodded, walking to the bed. I really needed some sleep, and yet when I thought about lying down, I realized that I wasn't tired. So I settled into a chair beside the window instead and looked down the skyscraper-lined street of Starsight. I watched all those people out there move, flow, a million different goals, a million different jobs, a million creatures who saw me as one of the most dangerous things in the galaxy. Embot, I asked, can you hear those people down below, on the street?
Not sure, he said. That was a lie. I can totally hear them. How was my lie, though?
Try not to tell people that you're lying immediately after you do it. It ruins the effect.
Right. Okay, then. Not sure.
He started humming. Could you maybe not practice your lying right now? It's getting a little annoying.
Spencer, he said, you're not supposed to like it when I lie, right? How do you know when to do it and when not to?
I sighed.
All right, fine, he said. I have advanced surveillance equipment. From this height, I might be able to isolate audio from people on the street, though it's no guarantee and will depend on interference. Why?
I just want to know what they talk about, I said. There aren't any Krell raids for them to anticipate. Do they talk about manufactory jobs? About the humans? Maybe the Delvers?
I'm scanning for a sampling, Embot said. It seems, for now, they talk about normal things. Picking their kids up from care centers. Ordering ingredients for dinner. The health and training of their pets.
Normal things, I repeated. Is all of that normal?
That seems like it would depend on a large number of variables.
I stared down, watching everyone move. The people walking past displayed that same lack of urgency I'd noticed when I'd first flown in. This place was busy, but only because there were so many pieces moving at once. Individually, it was peaceful. Normal? No, I couldn't believe it. This was the superiority, the empire that had practically destroyed humankind. They were the ones who funded Winzik and his Krell domination of my people. These were the monsters I'd spent my life training to fight, the faceless creatures who had lurked in the sky, bombing our civilization centers and bringing us nearly to extinction. Starsight was one of their primary trade and political hubs. This place had to be a front intended to make it seem like life in their empire was peaceful. How many of those people passing on the street were in the superiority's employ, directed to act innocent? It seemed so obvious, now that I thought about it. This was an act, a way to give outsiders a false impression of how great the empire was. Well, I wouldn't believe their lies of peace and prosperity. I'd seen how they treated the pilots at the test today. All those people on the street,
They were culpable for what had been done to my father and my friends. These weren't just simple people going about their simple lives. They were my enemies. We were at war.
Spensa, Embot said. Not to be a nag, but it has currently been 15 hours since you have slept, and, as you're adjusting to this station's sleep cycle, I recorded only 4 hours of actually restful sleep for you last night.
Yeah, so? I snapped.
You get cranky if you don't sleep.
No, I don't.
Do you mind if I record your tone for later, to use as evidence against you in a future disagreement?
Scud. Arguing with a machine was an unreal level of frustrating. He was probably right, but I also knew I wouldn't be able to sleep if I tried. For reasons that he, no matter how smart, would never be able to understand. Instead, I changed into the generic work jumpsuit that had arrived in that bundle of clothes I'd ordered, and went back up to the rooftop. The jumpsuit felt like a flight suit, thick, canvas-like material with a fit that was snug, but not too tight. Comfortable, utilitarian clothing. The best kind.
Spensa, Embot said as I walked over to the ship. You're not going to get yourself into trouble somehow, are you? We aren't flying off to—
Relax, I said. We can't let their ground crews get too close to you, which means I'm going to have to keep you maintained.
Now, Embot said.
I want you in tip-top shape, in case we need to make an escape. I checked the little maintenance locker on the rooftop and found some basic supplies, including a grease gun filled with vacuum-rated lubricant. I grabbed that and walked back to him. Embot, I asked. How did you learn about that phrase I used? About the teeth? Did you have it in your databases?
No, he said. I got it from the Starside Information Archive. There's a great deal in here about old Earth, from before it vanished, more than the fragmented databases your people have.
Can you tell me about it? I asked, using the gun to begin greasing the joints of his wing flaps. Some of the things we don't cover in school, you know?
There's a lot of information here, he said. Shall I just start in alphabetical order? A.A. Atanasio was a science fiction writer who sounds interesting.
Tell me the story of Pineleaf, I said, and how she fought 4 crow warriors at once.
Fallen Leaf, Embot said, is often associated with the historical figure known as Pineleaf, or Woman Chief. She was a Native American woman of Gros-Vin birth, though many pseudo-historical accounts of bravery are associated with her life.
He said it so dryly, in such a monotone. And the story of how she fought 4 men at once? I asked, touching them each with her rod in turn, taking them captive due to the shame of letting a woman outfence them.
She is reported to have counted coup 4 times in 1 battle, Embot said, though it is uncertain if this legend is true. Historically, she was instrumental in turning back a Blackfoot raid, where she first gained renown among other Crow. And why are you sighing? Did I do something wrong?
I just miss Gran-Gran, I said softly. She made the stories of old Earth come alive, simply in the way she told them. There was always a passion in her voice that Embot, however well-intentioned, couldn't impart.
I'm sorry, Embot said softly. This is more proof that I'm not really alive, isn't it?
Don't be silly, I said. I'm not a very good storyteller either. That doesn't mean I'm not alive.
The Dion philosopher and scientist Zentu claimed that there are 3 important hallmarks that indicate true life. Growth is the first. The being must change over time. I've changed, haven't I? I can learn. I can grow.
Definitely, I said. The mere fact that you made me your pilot proves that.
Basic self-determinism is the second, Embot said. A living thing has to be able to respond to stimuli to better its situation. I can't fly myself. If I could fly, do you think it would make me alive? Do you think that's why whoever created me forbade me from being able to move on my own?
You can use your smaller thrusters to adjust your position, I said.
so you can kind of do that one already. If a plant is alive because it can respond to sunlight, then you're alive.
I don't want to be as alive as a plant, Embot said. I want to be really alive.
I grunted, applying quick squirts of lubricant to the hinges of his wing flaps. The mere scent of it made me feel better. That room down below, it was too clean. Even my quarters back at DDF headquarters had smelled faintly of grease and exhaust fumes. What's the third indication of life? I asked, at least according to this philosopher.
Reproduction, Embot said. A living thing is capable of making more versions of itself, or at least its species is capable of this at some point in its life cycle. I've been wondering. You're going to have to fly a new ship tomorrow. Maybe we can find a way to upload a copy of my program to that fighter's databanks. Then you could have my help, but still be able to fly one of their ships.
You could do that? I asked, looking up from the wing.
In theory, Embot said. I'm just a program, granted, one that relies on trans-cytonic speeds for processing. But at my core, the thing you call Embot is nothing more than a group of coded bits.
You're way more, I said. You're a person.
A person is nothing more than an organic collection of coded information.
He hesitated.
Anyway, my programming forbids me from making copies of my main processing code. There's a failsafe to prevent me from duplicating myself. I might be able to change it if...
Click. Click, 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 click. I kept working, falling silent as his program rebooted. Whoever made him didn't want to risk the enemy getting a copy of him, I thought. Or they didn't want to risk their AIs copying themselves without supervision.
I'm back, Embot finally said. Sorry.
It's fine, I said.
Maybe we can find a way around what I said earlier.
I don't know if I like that, honestly, I said. Making another of you feels wrong, weird.
No more weird than identical twin human beings, he said. To be perfectly frank, I don't know how my programming would respond to being confined in an ordinary computer system, one that doesn't have trans-cytonic processing.
You say those words like I should know what they mean.
To create computers that can think as quickly as my mind, you need processors that can communicate faster than normal electric signals facilitate. My design achieves this by using tiny cytonic communicators, which pass signals at FTL speeds through my processing units.
And the station's shield doesn't stop that?
My own shielding appears to be enough to block their shielding. Or, well, that's a simplified and maybe contradictory way of putting it. In any case, I can still process at my required speeds.
Huh, I said. Cytonic processors. So that's why I can feel you thinking.
What do you mean?
Sometimes, when I'm deep inside, whatever it is I do, I can feel you. Your mind, your processors. Like I can feel Braid sometimes. But anyway, talk of copying you is moot, right? We can't transfer you to a new ship, because that ship wouldn't be able to think fast enough.
I should be able to survive in one, Embot said. I'd simply think slower. I'd be dumb. Not as dumb as a human, though, and you all seem to get along just fine.
He paused.
No offense.
I'm sure you find our stupidity endearing.
Nope. Anyway, I'd like to at least try to find a way to replicate myself, if just to prove that I'm actually alive.
I walked around him toward his other wing, smiling. After I'd joined the DDF officially, and Embot had come out into the open, the ground crews had taken over maintaining him. Before that, though, it had just been me and Raj. Raj had done most of the difficult work, but a lot of the simple jobs, greasing, peeling paint, checking wires, he'd given over to me. There was something satisfying about maintaining my own ship, something relaxing, calming. Then I looked into the polished surface of his hull and saw infinity staring back at me.
a deep void in place of my reflection, one pierced by a handful of burning white lights, like terrible suns, watching me. The eyes. A delver, or more than one, was here. Right here. I stumbled back, dropping the grease gun with a clatter. The reflection vanished, and I swear there was nothing reflected for a short time. Then, like a screen turning on, Alanik's figure reappeared, the holographic image I was wearing.
Spensa, Embot asked, what's wrong?
I slumped down to the rooftop. Overhead, ships coursed along invisible highways. The city squirmed and moved, a sickening buzz of annoying insects all around, suffocating me.
Spensa,
Embot repeated. I'm all right, I whispered. I'm just worried about tomorrow, about having to fly without you. I felt alone. Embot was great, but he didn't understand me like Kimmelin or FM did, or Jorgen. Scud, I missed him. I missed being able to complain to him and listen to his overly rational, yet somehow calming, arguments back.
Don't worry, Spensa, Embot said. You can do this. You're really good at flying. Better than anyone else. You're practically inhuman in your skill.
I felt a chill at that. Practically inhuman. Feeling sick, I leaned forward, wrapping my arms around my legs.
What did I say?
Embot asked, his voice growing smaller.
Spensa, what's wrong? What's really wrong?
There's a story Gran-Gran would tell, I whispered. An odd one that never quite fit with the others. Not a story about queens, knights, or samurai. A story about a man who lost his shadow.
How do you lose your shadow?
Embot asked. It was a fanciful story, I said, remembering the first time Gran-Gran had told it to me. Sitting on top of our cube-like apartment back in the caverns, the deep, hungry light of the forges painting everything red. One strange evening, while on a journey, a rider woke up to find that his shadow had vanished. There was nothing he could do, and no doctor could help him. Eventually, he moved on with his life. Except one day, the shadow came back. It knocked on the door and greeted its former master with joy. It had traveled the world and had come to understand men better, in fact, than the rider himself did. The shadow had seen the evil in the hearts of the men of the land, while the rider had sat beside his hearth, entertaining only kind-hearted fancies.
That's strange, Embot said. Didn't your grandmother usually tell you stories about slaying monsters?
Sometimes, I whispered. The monsters slew the men. In this story, the shadow took the man's place. It persuaded the rider that it could show him the world, but only if the man agreed to become the shadow for a short time. And of course, when the man did so, the shadow refused to let him go free. The shadow took his place, married a princess, and became wealthy, while the real man, being a shadow, wasted away and became thin and dark, barely alive. I looked back at Embot. I always wondered why she told me that story. She said it was a story her mother had told her during the days when they'd traveled the stars.
So, you're worried about what? Embot said. That your shadow might take your place.
No, I whispered. I worry that I'm already the shadow. I closed my eyes, thinking of where the Delvers lived, the place between moments, that cold nowhere. Gran-Gran said that in the old days, people had feared and distrusted the engine crew. They distrusted Cytonics. Ever since I'd begun seeing the eyes, I'd never quite felt the same. Now that I'd traveled to the nowhere, I couldn't help wondering if what had come back wasn't completely me anymore, or if maybe the me I'd known had always been something else, something not quite human.
Spensa, Embot said, you said you weren't a good storyteller. That was a lie. I'm impressed at how you do it so easily.
I looked at the fallen grease gun, which had squirted a little glob of clear lubricant onto the rooftop. Scud. I was getting emotional. M-Bot really was right. I got strange when I didn't have enough sleep. That was it, obviously. Sleep deprivation was making me hallucinate, and it was why I was rambling. I stood up, pointedly did not look at my reflection, and put away the grease gun. I then stopped at the stairwell down into the embassy. The thought of sleeping in that sterile, empty room, with the eyes watching me. Hey, I said to M-Bot instead. Pop your cockpit. I'm going to sleep up here tonight.
You have an entire building with 4 bedrooms, M-Bot said. And you're going back to sleeping in my cockpit, like you did when you were forbidden DDF quarters?
Yep, I said, yawning as I climbed in and pulled the canopy closed. Could you dim the canopy for me?
I suspect a bed might be more comfortable, M-Bot said.
Probably would be. I leaned the seat back and dug out my blanket. Then I settled in, listening to the noise of traffic outside, a strange, somehow accusatory sound. Even as I began to drift off, I was left with a sense of isolation, surrounded by noise, but alone. I was in a place with 1,000 species, but I felt more lonely than I ever had exploring the caverns at home.
Part 3. Interlude. Jorgen Waite stepped into the infirmary, flight helmet under his arm. Perhaps he should have stowed the helmet, but there was no rule requiring it, and he felt good carrying it. Made him feel ready to fly at a moment's notice, gave him the illusion that he was in control. The creature lying in the infirmary bed proved that wasn't the case. They'd hooked the alien woman to all kinds of tubes and monitors, with a mask over her face to control her breathing. But what drew Jorgen's attention immediately were the straps binding her arms to the table. The DDF brass wanted to be extra careful, even though Spensa had seemed to think the alien wasn't a danger. The fallen pilot's alien physiology left the DDF medics scratching their heads. The best they'd been able to do was patch her up and hope she eventually woke. Over the last 2 days, Jorgen had checked on her at least 6 times. He knew it was unlikely she'd wake up while he was there, but he still wanted the chance to be the first to speak to her. The first one to make the demand. Can you find Spensa? He felt a growing sense of worry each day Spensa was away without communication. Had he done the right thing, encouraging her to leave like that? Had he stranded her alone, without backup, to be captured and tortured? He'd broken DDF chain of command protocol in telling her to go. Now, if she was captured because of it, well, Jorgen could think of nothing worse than disobeying, then realizing he'd been wrong to do so. So he came here, hoping. This alien was a cytonic. She'd be able to find Spensa and help her, right? But first, the alien had to awaken. A doctor with a clipboard stepped up to Jorgen, dutifully showing him the report on the alien's vitals. Jorgen couldn't read most of the chart, but people tended to be deferent to pilots. Even the highest government officials would often step aside for a man or a woman bearing an active duty pilot's pin. Jorgen didn't care for the attention, yet he bore it because of the tradition. His people existed, lived because the machine of war worked. And if he had to be one of its most prominent gears, he would bear that position with solemnity.
Any update?
He asked the doctor.
Tell me what's not on the chart. Has she stirred? Does she speak in her sleep?
The doctor shook her head. Nothing. Her heartbeat is irregular, and we don't know if that's normal for her species. She breathes our air just fine, but her oxygen levels are low. Again, we can't tell if that is normal or not. The same as before. And it could be weeks before she awakened, if she ever did. Engineering was analyzing her ship, but so far they hadn't been able to break the encryption on her databanks. The scientists could analyze that all they wanted.
The secrets Jorgen wanted were inside this creature's brain. He felt an electricity when he drew near her, a quiet shock that ran through him, like the sensation of being splashed with cold water. He could feel it now, standing over her, listening to the steady hiss of the respirator. He'd felt that same sensation before, when he'd first met Spensa. He'd thought it was attraction, and surely he felt that. For all she frustrated him, he was attracted like a moth to a flame. There was something else, though. Something this alien had, too. Something he knew was hidden deep within his family line. He turned to the doctor.
Please make a note to send me word if anything about her situation changes.
I've already done so, the doctor replied.
By the code at the bottom of the chart, you've updated her status priority, requiring me to renew my request. Department procedures 1173B.
Oh, she said, looking over the chart again. All right. Jorgen nodded to her, then left the infirmary, returning to the corridor of Platform Prime. He was on his way to his ship's berth to take the ground crew shift report when the klaxons went crazy. He froze, reading the pattern of buzzing alarms that rang through the sterile metal corridor. Incoming fire, he thought. Not good. Jorgen fought against the tide of scrambling pilots and crew members running for their ships and headed straight for the command room. Incoming fire, not incoming ships. The fighters weren't being scrambled. This was something bigger. Something worse. His stomach churned as he reached the command room, where the guards let him enter. Inside, the alarm sounds were muted. By now, the DDF had moved much of their command staff up from Alta Base to Platform Prime. Admiral Cobb wanted to separate the military installation from the civilian population to divide potential Krell targets. They were still setting everything up, though, which made this room a mess of wires and temporary monitors. Jorgen didn't bother the command staff, who had gathered around a large monitor at the far side of the room. Though he was of a rank to join in operations here, he didn't want to be a distraction. Instead, he made his way down the line of workstations to that of Ensign Nidora, a young woman in the Radio Corps whom he knew from their time in school together.
"What's happening?"
he asked, leaning down beside her. She responded by pointing to her monitor, which, by the designation at the bottom, was displaying a feed from one of their scout ships out beyond the shells. The feed showed two enormous Krell battleships moving toward the planet. "They're settling into positions," Nidora whispered, "where they can shoot through an upcoming gap in the defensive platforms and hit Alta Base on the surface."
"Can we fire back?" Jorgen asked.
Nidora shook her head. "We don't have control of the long-range guns on the outer platforms yet. And even if we did, those battleships are far enough away that they'd be able to move before our shots arrived. The planet, though, can't move." Jorgen's stomach twisted upon itself. From orbit, the enemy could bombard the surface of Detritus with a devastating rain of fire and death. With sustained shelling, and with the planet's own gravity working in the Krell's favor, those battleships would be able to obliterate even the deepest caverns.
"What are our chances?" Jorgen asked.
"Depends on how far engineering got." Jorgen felt helpless as he watched the two battleships glide into position, then open gun ports.
"No response to our requests to speak to them," someone down the row said. "Doesn't seem like they're going to give us a warning shot first."
That had always been the Krell's way. No warning, no quarter, no demands for surrender. The DDF knew, from the information Spensa had stolen, that much of what the Krell had done so far had been intended only to suppress the humans. 6 months ago, however, the enemy had moved to attempting full-on extermination.
"Why now, though?"
Jorgen asked. "They had to wait for an alignment of the platforms," Nidora said. "This is their first clear shot at Alta in weeks. That's why they're moving now." Indeed. Jorgen watched the screen as the inscrutable motion of the many platforms that made up Detritus' shells lined them up, providing an opening.
The battleships immediately started firing hefty kinetic shots, projectiles that were the size of fighters. Jorgen sent a silent prayer to the stars and the spirits of his ancestors who sailed them. For all his skill and training in a cockpit, he couldn't fight a battleship. The fate of humankind rested in the hands of the saints and the DDF engineers. The room grew so silent, Jorgen could hear his own heartbeat. Nobody breathed as the rain of projectiles dove toward the planet. Then something changed. One of the platforms at the side of the opening started moving, its ancient mechanisms lighting up. Data started streaming across Nidora's secondary monitor, reports from engineering and DDF scout ships. The planet Detritus was no easy target. Nidora's main screen highlighted the platform in motion, a flat sheet of metal. It seemed to move slowly, but so did the bombs. Jorgen was watching from such a distance that his brain had trouble comprehending the scale of the encounter. That section of metal was 100 kilometers across. As the bombs approached, sections of the platform opened up and launched a series of bright energy blasts into space. The blasts crashed into the projectiles fired by the battleships, meeting force with energy, blowing them away and negating their momentum. A shield sprang up around the platform, intercepting the debris, slowing it and preventing it from raining down upon the surface. Everyone in the room let out a collective sigh of relief. Nidora even whooped. The battleship slowly withdrew, indicating, although they'd fired on Alta itself and obviously wouldn't have minded destroying it, that this had been a test of the planetary defenses. Jorgen patted Nidora on the back, then stepped to the side of the room, breathing in and out to calm his nerves. Finally, some good news. One of the vice admirals called in over the main comm line to congratulate the engineers on their work. Oddly, though, Admiral Cobb himself remained in place at his monitor, limply holding an empty coffee cup and staring at the screen, even after all the others had gone to make announcements or offer congratulations. Jorgen stepped closer.
"Sir?"
he asked.
"You don't look pleased. The engineers got the defenses up in time."
"That wasn't one of the platforms our engineers worked on,"
Cobb said softly.
"That was Detritus's old defensive programming. We got lucky that a working platform was nearby and was still capable of deploying anti-bombardment countermeasures."
"Oh," Jorgen said. A little of his relief melted away. "But we're still safe, sir. Note the power readings at the bottom of the screen, Captain,"
Cobb said.
"The amount of energy that disruption drained is incredible. These old platforms barely have any juice in them. Even if we get others functioning, it will take months or years to fabricate new solar collectors. And even if we get that going, and the countermeasures continue to work, well, if the Krell start a sustained bombardment, they'll cut through these platforms eventually. Our defenses aren't meant to protect us from a long-term attack. They're a last-ditch failsafe, meant to stall invaders so that friendly battleships can get to the system and fight them off. Only we don't have friendly battleships."
Jorgen gazed back across the room of people celebrating. They looked commanding in their stiffly pressed and spotless DDF uniforms. That was just a front. Compared to the enemy's resources, the DDF wasn't an opposing military. It was a group of ragged refugees with barely a gun between them.
"We stay trapped on this planet," Cobb said. "And we die. It's that simple. We're an egg with an extra hard shell, yes. But we're done as soon as the enemy realize that they can't crack us with a spoon and decide to get a sledgehammer instead. Unfortunately, our only chance of escape vanished without a trace. That girl."
"I stand by my decision, sir," Jorgen said. "Spencer will come through for us. We just need to give her time."
"Still wish you'd called me,"
Cobb said. There hadn't been any repercussions for what Jorgen had done. He could argue that, under Code 17B, he'd been capable of making the call he'd made.
But the truth was that he hadn't even been the senior officer on that mission. Colonel Ng from the ground forces had been leading the security team. Jorgen should have talked to him, or called Cobb. It was possible that, in sending Spencer away, Jorgen had doomed them all. We stay trapped on this planet and we die. It's that simple. Jorgen took a deep breath.
Sir, I might need to disobey another rule. I don't know half of them anyway, Captain. Don't worry about it. No, sir, I mean, a family rule. Something we're not supposed to speak about.
Cobb eyed him.
You know, Jorgen said, about how my family fought to keep the defect from being talked about. Kept it from being known to the general public. The one that Spence's father had. The cytonics, Cobb asked. There's a reason, sir, Jorgen said. I know. Some of your ancestors had it. Wasn't confined just to the engine crews. You saying you've been hearing things, son? Seeing things?
Jorgen pressed his lips closed tight and nodded.
White lights, sir. In the corners of my vision, like eyes.
There. He'd said it. Why was he sweating so much? Speaking the words hadn't been that hard, had it?
Well, that's something at least,
Cobb said, and held his cup to the side. An aide helpfully grabbed it and ran to get him a refill.
Come with me. There's someone I want you to meet.
From the Fleet Psychological Corps?